You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we're joined by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern.
Kia ora.
What does the world of science have for us today?
Some really, 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 really old rocks. Isn't that exciting? I find it exciting. So Australia has, it turns out, some really old rocks. So if we think about us in New Zealand, we're quite used to living on a plate boundary, right? That's why we get a lot of earthquakes. That's why we have a lot of volcanoes. So we don't have a lot of old rocks because rocks typically get recycled. Like they go back into the center of the earth, they melted, they get reused kind of thing. Australia, that doesn't happen in certain parts because it's kind of not got a lot of plate boundary, right? So in the Pilbara region in Western Australia, they have these rocks that have been there for billions of years. And what they've, this paper that's come out recently is about dating some of these rocks to see how old they are. So, you know, you've got these rocks on the surface and they're weathered and stuff, but you can kind of, you still see evidence of what they would have looked like when they were first produced. So some of them do look kind of pillowy, like it was lava that erupted underwater and it cooled very quickly. So you get the kind of pillowy look. There are others, though, that have these really fine lines in them. And what these fine lines are indicative of is the signature of a meteorite shockwave. So something that's, it's a sign of something from space hit Earth. So it's an impact crater. And so they call these shadow cones. And so obviously, okay, that's really cool. But when did this happen? How old is this impact crater? So last year, these authors published this paper that put it at 3.4 billion years old. And they called their impact crater North Pole Dome. Kind of the worst naming ever, I thought, but
yeah,
you know.
Not quite catchy.
Yeah, not really, right? But then there were some people that disagreed with this age. So this paper recently is about looking at other ways of determining age and figuring this out. So why do we care? Deep time, it's a really hard thing to conceive of. Humans, Homo sapiens, been around for about the last 300,000 years. The Earth is 4.5 billion years old. So how do we know what's been going on for the last 4.5 billion years? We look at the rocks. They're the things that record this history, that they tell us the story for a lot of it. But as we've, you know, with these plate boundaries, there's these earth processes, so they get buried, they get folded, heated, lifted, all these sort of things. So it makes it really hard to figure out what the story is sometimes. And that's what geologists like to do, well, some geologists. So one of the ways that you work out how old specific rocks are, so these, in this case, these specific rocks that had these shadow cones, these fine lines in it, is you do stratigraphy. So this is just looking at the layering of rocks. So if you had a nice flat surface, you get some rock laid down and then some rock, other rock on top of it, so you know the stuff that's at the bottom is older than the stuff at the top. Or if you have like a vein that goes through the rocks, you know it's younger than the rocks around it. But as we said, there's been a lot of topsy-turvy sort of thing happening. And so these geologists, what they have to do is they have to look at the rocks in one place, in another place, and they correlate them. So they look, do they look the same? Do they have the same chemistry? Do they have the same magnetic signature? And so they have to do this massive three-dimensional puzzle with all these inputs of information. And that's where this initial estimate of this impact crater being 3.4 billion years old came from. But you can imagine, because it is this topsy-turvy three-dimensional puzzle, other people can look at it and interpret that data differently or see different things. And so another group came out not long after they published their paper last year and said, well, we think it's less than 2.7 billion years old. And they put the range of ages at 2.7 to 0.4 billion years old. So massive error. And so what this group has gone back is to use other ways of dating these rocks. I suspect they were always going to do this, but it kind of became more important for them to do it. And what they've done is they've actually looked at the rocks and what in these rocks can they use to date them more specifically. So if we think about, we know carbon, radiocarbon dating for archaeological items quite a lot. You look at the levels of carbon-14 to carbon-12 and you can tell how old a piece of skin was or a piece of pottery or something. That only works to about 50,000 years old. But there are other types of these carbon dating or radiocarbon dating systems that you can use for things much older. One of them's uranium to lead. So that's where they decided, okay, we're going to use a uranium to lead system, but what are we going to look at? What are we going to find in these rocks that we can look at? So one of the things they looked at were crystals of zircon. So within these rocks, you had these fine lines, but you also had these tiny little kind of crystal inclusions that looked like frozen lightning. And the idea was that these probably formed when the meteorite impacted these rocks. So they dated those. But there are other ways that these zircons can form in the rock. So it's not the best indication that they formed when the impact happened, right? Mm. So then they were like, what else can we look at? And so then they looked at apatites, which are calcium phosphates that form when hot fluid moves through cracks in rocks. So you can imagine if there's a big meteorite impacted the Earth, there's probably a lot of cracking in the rocks. There's probably a lot of hot fluid around. And so, yeah, you would get apatite form. So they did the uranium lead dating on those as well. And the zircon and the apatite gave similar results. And so they're using this as, okay, we've got this uranium lead date from minerals that we think would have formed when this impact happened. And so they put it at 3.02 billion years. So still really, really old, but a little bit younger than it was.
Dating old rocks is... It's one of those things that I don't think I've ever super understood past, like, the bare bones I got in high school chemistry, but it's so cool.
Yeah, like, I mean, just trying to conceive of those timescales, eh? It's just beyond my brain. It's so... it's just so big.
These things have been here for so long.
And the other thing is like, when you think, like, I was then reading about, okay, what would the planet have looked like back then? Mm. And they basically describe it as a water world, right? Most of the planet would have been underwater and there'd only be a little bit of continent. And it, yeah, it's just so trippy to think about how the Earth has changed over all that time.
And we can still find maybe the oldest crater.
Yeah.
Even after all that time.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Well, what do we have up next?
So next is a story around antimicrobial resistance. So
not good.
Not good. And I often bring this up because it's not good. So I actually found a figure that I hadn't seen before. So in 2019, they estimate that antimicrobial resistance was directly responsible for 1.3 million deaths globally and contributed to 4.95 million deaths. So that's a lot. So it is a massively big problem. What's also really a big problem with antimicrobial resistance, though, is biofilm. So bacteria and fungi, if they're in an environment that they don't really like, what they'll do is they'll excrete stuff to basically form a protective shield around them so that they can survive. When this happens, you actually need to use a lot more antibiotic than you normally would to kill the cells because they've got this protective shell. And it's estimated that actually bacterial biofilm causes up to 75% of life-threatening infections. So not only do we need to find new ways of killing these microorganisms and hopefully in ways that they're not going to develop resistance to, but we need to do it when they're in these biofilms as well. And so it's been a problem for a long time. There's a lot of different methods to trying to solve it. There's been a lot of issues around you can't make a lot of money out of it, so pharmaceutical companies maybe don't like going for it sometimes.
Lovely incentives in the medical industry.
Yeah, but one of the ways that people have been looking at is using peptides. So peptides are just small chains of amino acids. And you can see peptides, they get sold as supplements and stuff a lot. Be kind
that
of weary
is, that
and
is
stuff.
How I've like, heard of them, you so know, I was like, quite interested.
So, not endorsing any of that. This is a study that's a preclinical testing of these peptides for basically being antimicrobial in such a way that the microbes are less likely to develop resistance and can eradicate the biofilm. So, us as humans, we actually produce peptides that are antimicrobial. Often it's not so much for biofilm, but we call them planktonic. So when the bacteria are kind of floating around. So you can extract these peptides, but what's typically been found so far is that the concentration you need to eradicate biofilm has been so high that they actually become toxic for other reasons, or they're actually unstable. And so they haven't really been highly used. They've been hard to harness. But this group actually found this peptide. They said serendipitously, so by mistake, but or they weren't looking for it, but I couldn't actually find out what they were looking for. And they call it GK17, and they found that it was really good at killing bacteria and fungi, and the bacteria and fungi don't seem to be developing resistance to it. You've got to do multiple generations of the bacteria and fungi to look at this and see how it kills. But then they'd published that about 3 years ago, and then they wanted to see, okay, can we get it to kill, eradicate biofilm? So what they actually did was they made a mirror image peptide. So in nature, amino acids are all one way. They're like, you think about your left and your right hand, they're mirror images of each other, right? That's what amino acids are in nature. So you get the L type in nature. So they made their peptide out of the D type. And this is often because it's more stable and such. And they found it was actually really good at killing biofilms formed by the escape group. So the escape group is a clinically important group of pathogens. So these are what often we test new methods about. Escape, each of the letters kind of stands for one of the species. So like S is Staphylococcus aureus, which is clinically a problem.
I know that one.
P is Pseudomonas aeruginosa. And so each of them stands for something. And they either just use topical applications, so, you know, like rubbing it on the top, or they injected it, and they found that it was really good at killing the biofilm. And the way it did, this peptide did it, was it basically poked holes in the cells. So it caused pores to form in the membrane of the cells, and so then they kind of just fail. Yep. They just get holy and fall apart.
Holes in membrane, typically not great.
Exactly, right? What's really exciting, and what I didn't realise before reading this, was it's exciting. It works against fungi. Fungi are actually a key driver of disease and death in immunocompromised people.
Mm.
But we actually only have kind of four types of antifungal drugs, so four kind of groupings, not just four names that you buy from the pharmacist sort of thing. And so fungi are developing resistance to all the four types that we have. So that's where the authors of the study were like really excited, because they're like, oh, if this works against fungi, that's awesome, because, yeah, they might be the scarier thing, it looks like.
Wow.
If you think of like The Last of Us and all those sort of...
always feels scary, fungi. I love them, but yeah, they're also terrifying.
Yeah, no, I think you need a healthy respect for them.
Right? Yeah, we can coexist, but please don't
kill us.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, what is up next?
So we're going to have another primate story. I've done that for the last couple of times, so I keep it going. But a happier one. So this one's actually about primates and laughter. So we all love a good laugh, right?
Of course.
I don't think anyone ever complains about having a good laugh. So living great apes, so that's us, that's chimpanzees, bonobos, gorillas and orangutans, we all laugh. And what these researchers were interested in how we've developed speech, but one of the ways that they look at this is laughter across the great apes, right? And so they had recordings from multiple individuals of each of these species sort of things. Like, so they had 140 laughter sequences, and they analysed them, and what they found is actually we have a very similar rhythm to the way we laugh, which I found kind of amazing. And I was like, really? And if you go on the, you can go on the website that reports this study, and you can listen to, and you can actually kind of hear it. I'm not going to try and imitate it. And it's, we basically produce these evenly spaced rhythmic intervals between the successive sounds. So, yeah, like it's kind of like a beat into your laugh kind of thing. And why this is really interesting is because we're sharing this, right? And our last common ancestor was 15 million years ago. So what that means is 15 million years ago, there was this animal or species that, its progeny, it separated out into the different species, and that's what we are, the great apes now. And so that, because we all share the same rhythmic laughter or rhythm to our laughter, probably means it was a part of our shared common ancestor had it.
Mm.
So we've been doing this kind of laugh for 15 million years. What's kind of interesting though, like obviously we have evolved, right? We are speaking, we do, you know that your laugh when you're nervous is different to the not laugh that when you get tickled, to the laugh when everyone else is laughing and it's that infectious laughter, right? So our laugh has become faster, it's become more variable, and it's gained context-dependent control. So, you know, we can alter our laugh in response to the context we're in.
Like words, almost.
Exactly, right.
Language.
Yeah, so it's kind of, you know, these evolutions in the way that we control our vocalizations, right? And so that's where the laughter comes into, and then studying with speech. But I thought it was kind of, I saw the headline at first and I was like, that can't be right. Like, and then when you listen to the recordings, you're like, oh, okay. Yeah.
It's a nice and wholesome one too.
Yeah.
That's good to think about great apes laughing.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's such a joyous, I've got to go find one of those recordings because I'm sure it's awesome.
Yeah. No, I think it's definitely a good thing to do in your day.
Well, but thank you so much. Thanks, Kushla, for joining us. Thank you, Motet, and thank you, Science. Ngā kōrero rererangi, Aviation Conversations returns on 2nd of July. Enjoy a lively panel discussion on the dark sky movement, featuring guest speakers Nikki MacArthur, MNZM, and Josh Aoraki. Book now at motet.nz.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.